For all that slavery was abolished 200 years ago, the terrible truth is that not only is slavery still flourishing, but there are, according to UN estimates, more slaves in the world today than at any other point in human history. Now, in a landmark piece of investigative reporting, journalist Benjamin Skinner has documented an international network of human traffickers and slave traders. In a book called A Crime So Monstrous, Skinner tells the story of how he infiltrated slave markets on five different continents, from slave quarries in India to child markets in Haiti. He told Anne Strangechamps about what he learned, beginning with the fact that if you're standing in the middle of Manhattan today, you're 5 hours away from negotiating the sale in broad daylight of another human being.
The distance that all of us are from modern-day slavery is actually even smaller than 5 hours. But in that instance, in the first chapter, I wanted to drive the point home by taking readers on a journey that I took myself, stepping on a plane at JFK International Airport and getting out at Port-au-Prince in Haiti. You go to one particular street, Delmas 69, and there are four or five men who, when I was there, were standing in front of a barber shop. I pulled up in a car. One of them approached and said, "Do you want to get a person?" At this point, I began to negotiate with this individual for a human being, and I made it very explicitly clear from the beginning that I wanted this person to be a child, and I wanted this person to be mine for unpaid labor, for domestic work.
Isn't slavery illegal in Haiti?
Slavery is illegal. Human trafficking is not, as of
today.
What's
the difference?
Well, that's a very good question. In essence, it's as if slavery is illegal. The internal slave trade, as it were, is not illegal. And even the buying and selling, there's a fiction around. For example, the individual that I was negotiating with for this child, he said, "I don't sell children," although it would seem that way. "I place them," and he gets a fee for that placement.
How old are these children?
The maximum age, and this is the one legal restriction that has been brought in, although it is rarely enforced, is 15. In general, they're somewhere between age 7 and age 15. And the children that I was encountering were in the main under 10 years old. Mm. And these were children that were carrying water, they were cleaning chamber pots, they were doing laundry, they were cooking. And there's another aspect to this. When I was discussing a sale of what I made clear I wanted to be a 9-year-old girl, at one point, the gentleman who I name in the book leaned in and said, "This is rather a delicate question, but would you want this child as a partner as well?"
For sex.
For sex. And my immediate thought was, "Well, I'm glad you think so highly of me." And then my second thought was, If it's possible to have this child as a domestic slave, and this is what I said to him, as well as a partner, then I'd like that. And he said, "No problem."
Wow. Did you go ahead and complete the sale?
I didn't. And this was, I should say, the first time where I actually had the ability to go through with the sale or to not go through with the sale. And it took a lot of soul searching. It took several nights of, frankly, sleepless nights about whether I would buy this child and then put her in an orphanage, obviously take care of her, or allow this child to be given over to fate. And frankly, there's no easy answer to it, but I looked at historical precedents. I looked at great journalists like Nick Kristof, a columnist at the Times, had been in a similar situation where he had purchased a young girl's freedom from a brothel and sent her back to her village with a small amount of money. When he returned 2 years later, he found that she was right back in the brothel, that she was then addicted to crystal meth and back in slavery. I thought that this is something that either I'm going to commit wholeheartedly to take care of this child, or I can't commit at all.
I suppose you never found out what child you might have bought or what happened to her.
I didn't. What I did is I went up into the highlands of southern Haiti to an extraordinarily remote village. And in this village, every single family had given away a child to a trafficker.
Did they know what would happen to their children?
They had a pretty good idea because certain children had returned and had told them of the abuse. It's not an easy decision to make for a parent. That's putting it lightly. Imagine you're watching your child slowly starve in front of you, and you have no prospect of putting food in front of them in a year. It's an easy thing to say, I shouldn't give my child over as a slave. It's a much harder thing to say, I should watch my child slowly starve in front of me. Freedom or death is a very nice slogan, but it doesn't work in all instances.
Is that what parents told you? And when you talked with them about why they'd given their children away?
They said, we have no other choice.
Did they appear to have suffered by making that decision themselves?
To say that they've suffered is definitely an understatement. I mean, to know, to have knowledge of the fact that you have given your child over to an extraordinarily abusive situation where that child may well have been raped is a level of guilt that I hope none of us have to feel.
I want to ask you about another trip you took, this one to Romania, a country that is part of the European Union, where you found that you could buy a girl for the price of a used car. How did you go about meeting a human trafficker there?
It's a bit like the old mafia movies where somebody's an FBI agent is going undercover. I never envisioned myself doing this kind of thing, but I talked to local journalists. They would put me in touch with somebody else, usually a low-level criminal, in this case a credit card scammer. And then that person would introduce me to somebody else, and that person would introduce me to somebody else, and eventually we would find a place where human beings were bought and sold. And at that point, I would also be at the end of a very attenuated, very long stretched line and was realizing that my safety was very much in the hands of the people that I trusted until that point.
I was going to ask how dangerous this was. I mean, I'm assuming if they had figured out you were not for real, you would have been killed.
This was an instance where I think you're probably right. And I was wearing a wire. I was recording the conversation secretly. And we went to a broken-down mansion where a Roma family, the Roma are perhaps the most marginalized people in Eastern Europe. The vast majority of them are law-abiding, if desperately poor. There are a few that form hardcore center of criminal mafias that have been the focus of Interpol and Romanian police efforts. This was one of these guys. His shirt was open. He had a dragon emblazoned on his chest. The first thing I said to him was, I want to buy a girl. And he said, come back. So we go into this building and we're told, wait here. And we hear a scream above us. And a woman comes down and she's talking very quickly and she says, she doesn't want to come, she doesn't want to come, she's afraid you're going to hit her. Before I have a chance to respond, the woman goes back upstairs, we follow. We're standing in a hallway, off to our right is a darkened room. Out of that room comes a third woman clutching a young woman with Down syndrome. And on one of her arms is no less than 15 or 16 angry red slashes as if she's been trying to kill herself. And they what got to me more than anything was they put makeup on her and they applied it so hastily in an attempt to make her beautiful that from her eyes she was crying. The mascara had run down her face and the lipstick was spread beyond her lips. And I thought to myself, well, okay, I've got to stay in character here because this is somewhat of
a
dangerous situation. And I thought, well, what would my character do? Would I be happy to see this person? And so I tried to smile. And it is a terribly difficult thing to smile in a situation like that, and I couldn't do it. And at this point, I said, okay, let's go. Let's get away from here. So we went downstairs, and I went back to the original fellow with the pimp with the dragon on his chest and said, how much for her? And he said, 2,000-3,000 euros. And I said, well, that's too much. How about a trade? How about a motorcycle? And he said, not a motorcycle, a car maybe, a used car. And I said, a dacha, a local make of car. I'd estimated that I could get that for about 1,500 euros or about $2,000 at the right chop shop. And he said, okay. And that was how much that girl cost.
And then the deal was you would have her forever.
What he said initially was, you can have her for 2 or 3 months, but I want a deposit in case you decide to keep her longer. Again, it's another way of saying you're buying this girl.
You're buying her. I can't imagine how you felt walking away. I mean, you couldn't buy her, but you had to leave her there.
And this was the terrible part of this book. My models for this early on were Samantha Power and Philip Gorovitch, who wrote absolutely stunningly beautiful books on genocide. But in those books, the people that they were writing about, in many instances, were dead. In this case, I'm writing about people that are very much still alive. And the point of writing this book was to take that discovery on my part and say to the readers, okay, this is now you. This is now on you. This is your job. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that those people are free. And as I say in here, I very much intend to go back to these places and look for these people. But all of us can do something. All of us.
Benjamin Skinner, talking with Anstrain Champs about his new book, A Crime So Monstrous. You can find more information, including a list of modern abolitionist groups, on our website at ttbook.org.